Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, Just an Ordinary Guy. Hello everyone, and welcome to today's episode of Brains Matter. On today's show, I speak to Dr. Michael Brown from Monash University on the Square Kilometre Array. No doubt you've heard a fair bit about it in the science media over the past few years. Now we'll find out what it's all about. I've got Dr. Michael Brown here from Monash University. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
It's a pleasure to be back.
And today we're going to be talking about the Square Kilometre Array, but before we get into that, do you just want to give us a quick rundown on telescopes in general and the different type of telescopes you can have?
Of course, there's a myriad of telescopes out there, and the ones that people are most familiar with are those that work in visible light, the light that we see, where you use a lens or a mirror to collect the light and then focus it towards an eyepiece or a digital camera or even an old piece of photographic film and build up an image that way. But there's a myriad of other telescopes out there. So you have telescopes out in space, not just Hubble Space Telescope, but also Spitzer Space Telescope that looks at infrared light, the light that comes from sort of hot objects that are at temperatures of sort of hundreds of degrees or less. You have telescopes out there that detect X-rays, which come from the most energetic objects in the universe, and even telescopes that look at gamma rays, which are even more energetic. And then you have telescopes that are looking at even lower energies. So you have telescopes such as the Herschel Space Telescope that is looking at submillimeter. And of course, then at even lower wavelengths, you have the radio telescopes, which are detecting radio waves. So things such as Parkes and SKA eventually, and the Very Large Array in New Mexico, all these large things that look like satellite dishes.
So you mentioned the visible telescopes and then radio telescopes at the submillimeter level. What kind of telescopes are there in between which do all the other things that you mentioned? Are they radio-type telescopes or something else?
There's sort of a whole graduation of different telescopes out there. So you have the optical telescopes looking at the visible light telescopes, looking at the wavelengths we see. Those telescopes can also operate in sort of the near infrared, which tends to pick up things that are sort of at about 1,000 degrees in temperature. You then go to the submillimeter telescopes, some of which are on the ground, some of which are in space, which are sort of halfway between the radio telescopes and the visible light telescopes. They've sort of got some features of some telescopes, some features of the others, and they're looking at sort of dust that's sort of tens of degrees above absolute zero, tens of Kelvin. And then the radio telescopes are looking at even longer wavelengths. So, for instance, the visible light that we look at, the wavelength of it is half a micron, half a millionth of a metre. And when we get to the radio telescopes, we're looking at things where the wavelength's about 20 centimetres. Mm-hmm. And there we start looking at things. We do see a little bit of stuff that's being radiated by sort of hot things due to their temperature, but we also see a lot of other things. In particular, we see synchrotron emission. So we're looking at electrons spiraling in a magnetic field, and they emit radio waves. And it's the same sort of synchrotron process that, say, operates at the synchrotron just near Monash University in Melbourne, mm-hmm. Just looking at lower energy radiation.
And so in terms of the SKA you mentioned, it's a radio telescope. So how is it being planned? How is it going to work?
It's going to be a pretty amazing piece of technology. So the telescope itself is going to be what we call an interferometer. So rather than building one single dish that is a square kilometre in size, like a kilometre in diameter,
that would be very difficult to construct, of course.
It would be very, very difficult to construct, and even harder to move around. So instead of building one single dish, what's going to happen is there's going to be an array of smaller dishes which are connected together electronically to behave like a single giant telescope.
So I guess the analogy for that is you can have, if you want to bury, 25 tons of dirt, you can either have one big 25-ton hole or 25
one-ton holes and having 25 people dig 25 one-ton holes as opposed to one person digging a 25-ton hole, it becomes easier to dig and you're still able to pour all the dirt in.
Yeah. So there's definitely economies to be made there. There's also advantages in performance. So one thing that one can do with telescopes is the sort of resolution, the ability of us to see fine detail in an object is defined by the diameter of the telescope. And what one can do with an array of smaller telescopes is one can spread them out over a very large area. So rather than sort of spreading the telescopes over just 1 kilometer in diameter, one could spread them out over tens or hundreds and even have some outrigger telescopes 1,000 kilometers away, mm-hmm. and get the ability to see fine detail that you would get from a telescope that's 1,000 kilometers in diameter. Mm-hmm. So while the square kilometer array, the intention is to have a square kilometer of collecting area, the ability to collect light that's equivalent to a single dish a square kilometer in size, we can get finer angular resolution than such a telescope. We can see finer detail in celestial objects by spreading our array of telescopes over a very large area.
So is the intent at this stage to put outlying telescopes belonging to the SKA, or is it to use other telescopes around the world that already exist as part of that network?
The intention is to actually have new telescopes, part of the SKA, mm-hmm. from by design from the word go, feeding into this array. So there's certainly been a history of connecting various telescopes together in this fashion to obtain very high angular resolution. For example, many times people have connected Parkes, the Dish and Tidbinbilla near Canberra to build such a sort of telescope. But the SKA, it's going to be designed from the word go to sort of do this. Mm-hmm. And there's certain ways that you can spread the antennas around to get an optimal image. Certainly, just having two telescopes 1,000 kilometres apart gives you some of the capabilities of a 1,000-kilometre diameter telescope, but doesn't give you all of them. Nothing's for free. Mm-hmm. And there's some fairly severe penalties that you pay by doing that. But the SKA is going to move, have the telescopes arranged in an optimal pattern so that we get as close as we can to that 1,000-kilometre telescope without having to build a 1,000-kilometre dish.
Mm-hmm. So for those who aren't familiar with radio astronomy, going with an array of telescopes, they're obviously spaced at a certain distance apart, whereas mentally, if you think of a 10-metre-wide telescope,
mm.
as opposed to 10 1-metre-wide telescopes, and then you can spread those out a little bit, there is a bit of a gap between those telescopes. Is there a difference in the collecting capability of a 10-metre-wide telescope, which has the full collecting area, versus 10 1-metre telescopes where you actually have gaps in between?
There are some penalties that are paid. And certainly, you know, in the ideal situation, to get the optimal performance, you would have the giant mm-hmm. single dish. There are ways, though, to spread those little telescopes around to sort of reduce the penalty that you pay by having gaps between the telescopes. So you can have an array of spacings spanning all sorts of different scales that would help minimize some of the artifacts that you have coming through from only having a certain number of telescopes spread around. So you'd have some telescopes that are spaced together. They might only be separated by a few tens of metres. You'd have others that are separated by several hundred metres, several kilometres, several tens of kilometres, and several hundred kilometres. And you try to sort of space those around so that you have a large array of different distances between the different telescopes. Mm-hmm. And that would help mitigate some of those effects.
So that's also through some understanding of where these penalties are and doing some computation to overcome those as well, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And so if people go to, say, the Square Kilometre Array website or the ASCAP website, that's the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder website, they'll see pictures of where the telescopes are distributed, and they'll see there's sort of this pattern and there's this concentrated core, and then there's telescopes spread over a much larger area of the countryside.
So we've got radio telescopes around the world, and as you mentioned before, we've previously networked a few of them together. So why is there a need for the Square Kilometre Array?
So the Square Kilometre Array introduces a lot of advantages over previous telescopes in terms of its ability to get fine angular detail and its sensitivity. And the sensitivity really is a massive increase mm-hmm. on what we have had available to us previously. So at the moment with radio telescopes, a lot of the things that we look at are quite unusual and quite rare. So for instance, when we look at a particular frequency, let's say 1.4 gigahertz, what we see, extremely massive black holes that are taking in material extremely rapidly, and they're these extremely powerful luminous sources. Or we see galaxies that are forming stars, but they're forming stars at a tremendous rate, much higher rates of forming stars than, say, a typical galaxy like the Milky Way. So if you like, we're building a map of the Earth, but we're only allowed to map those bits of the Earth that are, say, 5 kilometres in altitude and above. This is giving us information, but it's giving us a very skewed view of the universe, whereas the SKA and to a lesser extent the Australian Square Kilometre Pathfinder are going to be so much more sensitive that we're going to see normal galaxies and normal parts of the universe. We're going to see almost everything, particularly in the nearby universe. Every single galaxy in the nearby universe is going to be detected at some level, and it means that we get a much better understanding of what's going on rather than just sort of looking at the most extreme objects in the universe.
So it's almost a sense of we have a window that we're looking outside from a building upon, and all we understand of the outside world is what we see of that window, whereas this is allowing us to walk out that front door.
In some respects, yeah, exactly. It's really providing a tremendous gain, a tremendous opportunity. So, for example, the current surveys that pick up hydrogen gas in the universe have picked up, detected neutral hydrogen gas in on the order of sort of 5,000 to 10,000 galaxies all up, and they're the nearest galaxies. With the sort of Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder, we're going to expand that to about 500,000 galaxies, give or take. And with the Square Kilometre Array, it's going to be millions and millions of galaxies spread over much of the history of the universe. So we're going to get a really comprehensive view, you know, instead of just having a view of a few thousand galaxies in our very nearby neighbourhood, we're going to be able to see much of the history of the universe with normal galaxies, the sort of normal galaxies that might evolve into things that are like the Milky Way, that are like our nearby companions like Andromeda. And it's going to provide a much more comprehensive view of how our universe is behaving and how it's evolved over cosmic time.
And in terms of the SKA project itself, do you want to go through a little bit of the background of that? Because as I understand, there have been several countries who have been vying for the project to be put into their country. And it's on, given that it's timely that it's been Eurovision for those people, especially in Europe and across... I know it's quite big in Australia. It's not that dissimilar, is it, in the sense that people are putting up their candidacy for it, and there's been people knocked out and finalists and so on.
Yeah, there has been. So what happened was, instead of a song for Europe, what's happened is astronomers have thought of a radio telescope for the world, and there was a recognition that if astronomers around the world pooled their resources together, their ideas together, their technology together, they could build a much more powerful facility than if they were operating in a piecemeal fashion. And so this is where the concept of the Square Kilometre Array began to take place. And radio astronomers around the world have been very enthused about this, have you know, and there's a lot of great science that can be done with this. They've then been discussing where to locate this telescope, where the optimal site is, and there were four candidates originally: Chile, China, South Africa, and Australia. And there was a lot of site testing done to sort of see if they were suitable sites.
What constitutes a suitable site? So I'm assuming low radio interference from local cities and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So a radio telescope, while it wouldn't be pointed at a nearby city, the emissions, the radio stations, the mobile phones, the computers, the electronics, all emit radio waves, and some of those do get detected by radio telescopes. So we want to position the radio telescope as far from those sources of interference as possible. And then there's also other sort of figures of merit for the site. So, for instance, the Chilean site had quite a few things going for it, but it was quite remote. actually didn't have a history in radio astronomy, so there wasn't quite the support there as well. And also the shape of the country meant that you couldn't quite distribute the antennas in the optimal way, and that was one of the reasons it got knocked out. For similar reasons, China got knocked out as well, and also with China, of course, there's issues with radio interference as well. It's a big country, but there's also a lot of people there, and there's going to be an increasing amount of radio interference. So at the moment, the choice is between South Africa and Australia, and a final decision is going to happen in the next year or two on which of those sites does win the contest for a radio telescope for the world. But both countries are building pathfinders to sort of demonstrate technologies, to demonstrate the capabilities of their respective sites.
So is the Pathfinder basically a small version of the SKA, or how does that relate to the SKA?
It is very much a miniature version in both cases, and it is a technology demonstrator, but it's also capable of doing great science in its own right. Mm-hmm. So the Australian Pathfinder is the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder. It's going to be built, or actually is being built, I should say, in the Western Australian desert, a couple of hundred kilometres from Geraldton, and it's going to consist of 36 antennas rather than the many hundreds or thousands of antennas for this full SKA. And it's going to be an extremely powerful telescope. So, for instance, it's going to be approximately 100 times more sensitive to radio waves when it's doing large surveys of the sky than the Very Large Array in New Mexico, which is sort of the benchmark radio telescope for the past 30 years or so.
So how does that one compare to the South African Pathfinder?
So the Australian Pathfinder and the South African Pathfinder are very much geared towards different science. So the Australian one is a survey telescope. It's going to survey the entire southern sky, and it's very much intended to look at large numbers of objects, and it's going to sort of carry out the discovery-type projects or pathfinders of the discovery-type projects that the SKA will do, whereas the South African one is going to study much smaller patches of sky in greater detail, both looking for more sensitive or fainter radio sources and a greater angular detail. And so they're complementary. They're sort of pathfinders for two very different aspects of the Square Kilometre Array science.
What are the main advantages of having it in Australia compared to, say, South Africa, or is that a pretty tough call to make?
Each of the sites has its merits. The Australian one has, you know, some advantages relative to the South African one. I mean, one is the population density is extremely low. So
it's going to be, as you mentioned before, near where the current Pathfinder is, which is the West Australian desert.
Yeah.
You know, having been out there, it's miles and miles of flat land of nothing.
Yes. So I think it's, I believe it's in a region that's about the size of Belgium with a permanent population of about 200 people. Mm-hmm. So in terms of radio interference from people getting mobile phones and computers, etc., that's somewhat of an advantage, whereas the population density in South Africa is somewhat higher, though of course South Africa has its famous deserts as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's one advantage. And of course Australia does have a longer tradition of radio astronomy than South Africa, although South Africa has been doing a very impressive job of building up its radio astronomy credentials and has built up an amazing community there in the past decade or so. So they're both very viable contenders.
In terms of your involvement with the SKA, what are you working on and what do you hope to get out of the SKA no matter where it's built?
So I think that's a good point, that actually the scientists in Australia and South Africa are very much involved in SKA, and they will be irrespective of where it's built. Though, of course, there'll be significant advantages if it's sited in Western Australia. And it'll be a great boost to Australian science and the Australian astronomical community. For my own personal interest, there's just a huge array of science that gets opened up for me with the SKA. So I study galaxy evolution, how galaxies have built up and grown over cosmic time. And so, for instance, one thing that I'm very interested in is, are galaxies growing because they merge together with other galaxies, or are they growing because they're forming new stars? And with the SKA, we'll be able to detect the radio emissions that result from the formation of new stars and the supernovae that soon after accompanied the formation of new stars. So I'll be able to see, oh, these galaxies, this particular population of galaxies is forming about one new star every year, and I can multiply that by the age of the universe and get a sense of how rapidly this galaxy has built up over time. I'm also very interested in how star formation is regulated in galaxies. And one idea is that these black holes that reside within galaxies might emit enough energy to sort of regulate the formation of new stars by regulating the gas temperature in galaxies, sort of a thermostat that stops the gas getting too cold. With the SKA and with the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder, we'll be able to see these black holes, even if they're sort of tuned down and just operating at sort of a very low sort of base level, rather than the very extreme black holes that we tend to observe now. So it really does offer a large, really great opportunities for understanding how galaxies have evolved over cosmic time.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And what is your initial prediction at this point for what the announcement might be? Or is it too close to call?
I think it's still too close to call, though I have my fingers crossed and I hope that Australia is in the lead when it comes to this particular race.
So if there was someone out there listening to this podcast at the moment and you wanted to sell the Australian position to them, what would you say?
Well, I would say that the Australian site, in many respects, it has advantages over the South African one. With the telescope sited in Australia, it's a billion-dollar project, the full SKA. Mm. And so it's going to bring a tremendous investment in science to Australia, tremendous investment in various technologies. So, for instance, the Square Kilometre Array is going to produce about 2.5 gigabytes. Actually, it's going to produce many gigabytes of data every single second. And that data has to be processed with a supercomputer, and in fact the data has to be transported from the Australian desert to a supercomputer in Perth. The data has to be processed, and then that processed data has to be shipped to astronomers around the world. So there's a tremendous investment in technology there. And it's not just investment in technology from the Australian taxpayer. It's a multinational effort. There's going to be a tremendous opportunity for Australian scientists to collaborate with their international partners. And it's not just going to be astronomers who are doing that. It's going to be people who are working in engineering, in computer science, a whole range of technologies. So it's really a great investment in Australian science and Australian technology that should have benefits that go on for many decades.
Okay, well, Dr. Michael Brown, I'd like to thank you for your time today.
It's been a pleasure.
And good luck to both candidates. May the best candidate win, and good luck to South Africa as well.
Yes, and I'm sure the science will win in the end.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
And I hope you enjoyed that interview and learned about the Square Kilometre Array. Don't forget, if you have a smartphone, whether it's an Android phone or iPhone, you can get the Brains Matter app for your smartphone. Just head on over to the Brains Matter website to find links on where to get it. I'll leave you with a quote from Robert Hart. No one can be right all of the time, but it helps to be right most of the time. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right hand side. You can listen to the episodes from your browser by choosing Flash Player from the links and selecting whichever episode you want to hear from within the player. There's also other information on the site, such as links to articles and news, subscription details, both via iTunes and manually, and voting information. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.